This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Rescue mission in Puerto Rico. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
One woman's tale of trying to find her parents on the island after more than 10 days of no communication with them following Hurricane Maria.
TV has a new direction. Hear the network hit leading the way on highlighting economic diversity.
Newest fashion trend for the winter, jackets and coats insulated with some of Vermont's ugliest weeds.
And the new technologies being adopted in many major cities to replace parking meters.
When you drive in after you register and sign up for the app, the camera reads your license plate, and thus you're in, you're done. You do not have to pay for parking. It's just automatically charged to your app based on a camera reading your license plate.
Jeff Graham at USA Today on apps, sensors, and cameras handling today's parking revenue. He's here later in the hour. Hundreds of anxious friends and relatives from the mainland U.S. have set out for remote reaches of Puerto Rico to provide aid that has been slow coming from official sources. The American Red Cross says it has received more than 800 emergency welfare inquiries involving people trying to make contact with loved ones and has used trucks with mobile satellites to help 5,000 people reconnect with family. With 91% of Puerto Rico lacking power 3 weeks after Hurricane Maria, and 76% of cell sites inoperable, the communications breakdown on the island of 3.4 million people is widespread. Wall Street Journal reporter Ariane Campo Flores tracked one woman's mission to find her parents on the island. Ariane, what did you witness?
The woman that we wrote about, the daughter, Sonia Negron Bell, was gracious enough to sort of let us trail her as she went on this mission, which was basically like a solo relief mission that she herself decided to take on because she was so concerned about what her parents might be going through and also was not able, had lost contact with them and didn't know exactly what was going on. So she lives with her husband in Chicago, but her parents, about 20 years ago, after having lived for decades in Long Island, New York, moved back to Puerto Rico, and they built themselves a little house in a little town called Aguada, which is on the northwestern coast of the island. And after the storm passed, she just was not able to make contact with them. She called repeatedly, and as thousands of other people have experienced, there was just no way to get through.
Yeah.
The power was out. The telecommunication system was down. And so what she decided to do was embark on this trip to try to bring them supplies and see how they were doing.
How long was it between communications, say from by the time, like I think you said she checked in with them kind of the day before the storm hit to make sure they were prepared before they, and then after the storm, like what was that period of time between contact?
Yeah, so the last contact she had with them was the evening of September 19th, right before the storm hit. And that was a conversation which she was trying to make sure that they were prepared enough. And she came away from that call worried because she felt like they weren't. They didn't have, canned goods. They had perishable items, which obviously if the power was out, were going to go bad soon. And so she was disconcerted by that. Then after the storm passed, as I mentioned, she tried repeatedly to reach them, was not able to. And then about 12 days after the storm passed, her brother in New York received a text message from the father. And all it said was, things are bad here. And so they were both kind of frantically trying to reach him and get more from him, but they couldn't get through.
Wow.
And then, 2 days before her scheduled trip to the island, she got a call at about 2 a.m. in the morning from the father, and it was very brief because the signal was poor and he was worried about a cell phone battery. But in that brief conversation, he again repeated, things are bad here. And he said, there's no electricity, there's no food, there's no water. And she said, well, I'm coming to help you. And he said, no, don't come here. And he repeated that four times. And that was also very disconcerting to Sonia because, you know, her father and I met him. He's just this very resourceful, kind of, you know, solid elderly man who just, you know, clearly knows how to take care of himself. And she was just worried if he was talking that way, how serious things really were.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Ariane Campo Flores. This piece is called A Daughter's Mission, Rescuing Elderly Parents Stranded in Puerto Rico. The fact that she did not hear anything for 12 days, I can't imagine the worry that she went through. But she finally gets there, and then what?
So she leaves from the airport at about roughly 3 p.m. on a Saturday, and on a Friday, and sets out for Aguada. That trip is normally a 2.5-hour drive, but because the traffic was just terrible leaving the city that day, there was bumper-to-bumper traffic for something like 15 miles. They also made several stops along the way. They were trying to gather up water to take to them. So by the time that they roll into Aguada, it's nightfall, and the town was just completely just pitch black. I mean, it was just shrouded in darkness. The only light that you would see was occasional home that had clearly had a generator running, and so there was some light there. Mm-hmm. And so she drives through. She was just really taken aback by just what this town looked like, which is a place that she visits regularly to see her parents.
Yeah.
She drives up this steep hill to the neighborhood where her parents are, and she arrives there. And she was just so worried as she approached about what she was going to find. And what she found was that they had survived, but in very uncomfortable and really lamentable conditions.
Yeah.
Her father came out, you know, embraced with her husband. The mother kind of shuffled out. She has difficulty walking, and was clearly very happy to see her. And so they went inside, and the place was sweltering hot. There was no power. There was no light. Their refrigerator door was open. There was nothing in it. Mm. There were a couple buckets that had some water that they were clearly using for, you know, to clean stuff.
Can't even imagine. Wall Street Journal reporter Ariane Campo Flores. 14 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. The Climate Prediction Center says the La Nina weather pattern is likely to form over the next few months. La Nina is one of the main drivers of weather in the U.S. and around the world, especially during late fall, winter, and early spring. So what exactly does that mean for us potentially this winter? Here's Doyle Rice, weather editor at USA Today. Doyle, start with the basics. What is La Nina?
La Nina is kind of just the cooler sibling to El Nino. And amazingly, just that little bit of change in water temperature then really can make a huge impact on the atmosphere and then the weather patterns all over the world.
Wow. All right, so with the U.S., what does that generally mean, say, for different regions of the country if we wind up with a La Nina?
Yeah, how it impacts the U.S., it's often the Northwest gets colder and snowier. So folks out in Washington, Oregon, Montana, Idaho, and that area will likely see a very cold, snowy winter, which, of course, is actually good for all the skiers out there. They enjoy that. Then the other main factor usually is it's a much drier pattern all the way across the southern half of the U.S., from California all the way to Florida and everywhere along that whole area. You get a lot less precipitation usually in a typical La Nina winter. So a lot of those places, they don't get snow anyway, they just get rain. So it'll be a little bit less rain than usual across the southern tier. And then when you get over into the populated parts of the East Coast, it's kind of a mixed bag. Down around the Mid-Atlantic, maybe you get a little bit milder, a little bit warmer winters. But then as you get further north into the Great Lakes and New England, it can get to be colder than average and potentially snowier than average winter.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Doyle Rice, weather editor at USA Today. We're talking about his piece entitled La Nina is Expected This Winter. What will that mean for our weather. So you said this is going to form over the next few months. When will we know for sure that, in fact, we're having a La Nina winter, for lack of better phrasing?
Yeah, that it often is not until you actually get toward closer to winter itself, like until maybe sometime in November, or, you know, more certainly in December is when they'll have the best idea as far as whether or not we are going to actually have the La Nina. Right now they're pegging it at about a 55 to 60% chance of a La Nina forming within the next couple of months. They're officially, it's called a La Nina watch is how they define that, meaning that conditions are likely to form in the next couple of months.
All right. I just want to know, selfishly, in the middle part of New Jersey here, am I going to need the snowblower or not? I want you on record in the middle part of October right now.
Oh, golly gee. You live in a northern part of the country. Be ready. Whatever the long-term, long-range forecast is, just never give up that snowblower, never give up that snow shovel. You're more than likely will need it at some point this winter.
Very good. So in relation to El Nino, they're not one or the other, right? They're at different times of year.
It's a pattern shift. They can often last a few months. Like you'll say, oh, we're going into a La Nina, and so it'll be La Nina for 3 to 6 months, and then the pendulum might swing the other way, as I said, and El Nino will form. You can't have both at the same time. Basically, it's either one or the other or in between.
And this is all tied to ocean temperatures.
That's it. It's really amazing that, just as I said, just a few degree temperature shift in that part of the Central Pacific, either way, either colder than average or warmer than average, really can make a huge difference in weather, not just the U.S., but all over the world. It's probably the most well-known climate pattern that affects more people or more parts of the world than any other place. And I will say that the that there's other patterns that affect weather, but they can't be predicted as well. And those are the ones that often might impact the Northeast and the Midwest with heavy snow. Those are the kind of patterns that can't be predicted quite as far in advance as El Nino or La Nina.
Thanks, Doyle. Doyle Rice, weather editor at USA Today. 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. Network television is trying to add more working-class characters to reflect more economic diversity. One show standing out, The Middle, on ABC. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Network TV has gotten more creative of late while also trying to reach audiences divided along economic, political, and cultural lines. John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal has written about ABC sleeper comedy The Middle and has more. John, what's the premise behind The Middle?
It's pretty simple, and it shares a lot with a lot of different sitcoms. It's about a nuclear family trying to get by with work and school and other kinds of life obligations. But the twist here is that they're, very explicitly based in the Midwest. They are in a fictional town in Indiana, and they're also struggling, economically. They struggle to pay their bills. They struggle with financial aid through schools. They have busted appliances and kind of a cruddy house that they live in, which sort of sets them apart from a lot of the more upper middle class families on TV, you see.
How are the ratings, and what has resonated with audiences about the show?
The ratings have been solid, and it's not a smash hit, but it also does really well. It's kind of one of those cornerstone hits for the network. And has been for many years. I mean, the ratings have essentially been steady throughout the whole 8 and now 9 seasons it's been on TV, which is pretty remarkable in its own right, even though it's not, a big sexy hit like other shows. And I think for a lot of viewers who, are looking for maybe a more family-friendly show, they don't want to be running the risk of, watching TV with their kids when some, racier stuff happens. I think it's been kind of a reliable show in that way, too. It's also funny. It's just like a wry but kind of sweet show that does have a good sense of humor. And it's a little bit off base in a lot of what it shows, but is, pretty creative.
We're speaking with John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal. John, your story also mentions that Roseanne is coming back for just 8 episodes. What are they trying to hope to get out of that show?
That sort of speaks to a couple of different things going on TV. One is that, you know, every old hit from back in the day now seems to be resuscitated and brought back for a new lap, with sometimes with mixed results. So that's one side of it, too. But I think they also feel like, like almost every industry, the TV industry really had a wake-up call after, you know, throughout the last presidential election and the aftermath. And I think they're really starting to take a harder look at who the audience is and what the audience wants to see. The thinking there at ABC is that, you know, there's a lot of disenfranchised people and disenchanted people in the middle class and even lower middle class. And that show famously kind of spoke for that group, even if politically maybe it didn't sort of resonate for a lot of people too. So it's a little bit of a risky show to come back with, because I think a lot of people are divided about, you know, their memory of it. But I think they're hoping that the name recognition at least is going to bring some viewers to come in.
Are comedies doing better than more serious shows right now?
I think that they're doing fine, but, you know, I think you could look at some of the biggest ones, the biggest hits of last year, that show This Is Us, which is on NBC. It's a, you know, family drama. It's often a tear-jerking show, but it's, you know, it's a very kind of insular world of telling the story of this family. I think people really sort of gravitated to that.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal entertainment writer John Jurgensen, 30 minutes after the hour. On This Weekend. If you travel for business, you know it's a game of wins and losses. Popping open an overhead bin and finding it empty? Win. Sleeping through a wake-up call? Loss. Buying your business trip at Upside.com? That's not just a win, it's a triple win. Number one, Upside has the absolute best available prices for flights, hotel, and rental cars. Win number two, Upside will reward you with a gift card to places like Amazon.com every time you buy a business trip. And number three, the amazing 6-star treatment you'll get from Upside's customer service specialists, who they call navigators. And I'm going to start your Upside 6-star treatment right now. Go to Upside.com and use my code DEAL, and you'll get a minimum $100 gift card to Amazon.com. That's code DEAL for a minimum $100 gift card to Amazon.com when you buy your next business trip at Upside.com. Upside.com, you deserve a better business trip. Minimum purchase required. See site for complete details. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, how apps, sensors, and cameras are taking over city parking. Also, the secret to not getting the flu this year and this winter's hot fashion. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Habitat for Humanity has kicked off the repair and rebuilding phase of its Habitat Hammers Back Hurricane Recovery Initiative in Houston. It began earlier this week. We're joined now by Habitat's CEO, Jonathan Reckford. Jonathan, explain the mission.
Excited to be talking to you from Houston, Texas, where we announced Habitat Hammers Back, which is our total response to the devastating impact of Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. We want to help more than 2,000 families across Texas rebuild, more than 2,000 families across Florida rebuild, and more than 2,000 families across Puerto Rico rebuild after these devastating hurricanes. And that'll be a mix of repairs and new construction all across the region.
My goodness. How do the different families get chosen?
The way we choose the families is based on need. We really focus on low-income homeowners. And then we look to work with those who are willing to partner with us and need a gap between insurance or FEMA or other supports, they still need more help, and they need a trusted contractor who can come in and do the work for them as well. So the sad news is there are tens of thousands of families that need that help, and we're trying to figure out ways to help as many as we possibly can.
How long do you expect the project will last, Jonathan?
So we expect this will be a 3 to 5 year effort. That sadly, I think, our collective attention span is short, and a lot of attention is paid in the emergency response, where most of the money goes, and then we've got years of hard work to do the reconstruction and rebuilding. But Habitat for Humanity has experience in, sadly, responding to too many natural disasters around the world, and we have been in these communities for decades, and we're here for the long term.
What do you do in a place like Houston? You're going to rebuild and fix homes that are kind of in a flood threat area again?
So what we try to do is build in a way that makes sure that those families will be resilient. So the community we're in right now had never flooded in history.
Okay.
So this was really unprecedented. And, you know, this was the largest rain event in the history of the United States. So we actually believe this community, with a little bit of mitigation for drainage, will be very safe for a long time to come. But we make sure that if we're going to build in any area that's at risk, that we build in a way that house wouldn't flood the next time. So whether that's putting it at a higher elevation or other areas, elements of mitigation, we want to make sure that we're putting the family in a safe situation.
For the folks who get a new home rebuilt, do they resume a mortgage, I guess? Or how does that work?
So it's situation by situation. Generally, yes. So if a family gets a new home and they didn't actually were a renter before, then they would, in our traditional model, they would pay back an affordable mortgage, and we would recycle their payments back to help other families. If a family is already a homeowner and is already paying a mortgage, then we would be getting them back into the position that they could continue to make their mortgage payments and trying to fill the gap on the repairs. So it is context-specific, but in the new homes, generally, the families would be taking on mortgages.
What are the other partners who are joining you guys?
So we are blessed with a wonderful group of partners. The group, along with Thrive and Financial, that catalyzed this effort that we're building with today here, are also Dow Chemical, a longtime partner for us, General Motors, similarly, and a new partner for us, members of the American Wind Energy Association, who have come together to support Habitat's rebuilding work.
Yeah.
We are grateful for your help in tell the story. I think one of the things that people don't know is it's going to take a lot, and we estimate it'll take about $100 million. So we do need advocates, we need volunteers, but we also need financial resources for the scale of rebuilding that's required, and we're grateful for the support.
Thanks, Jonathan. That's Jonathan Reckford, Habitat for Humanity CEO. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for joining us. High-tech parking is probably coming to a meter near you, if it hasn't already. Welcome to the future, where you'll never have to scrounge for quarters and may soon add parking to your list of monthly subscriptions after Netflix. High-tech parking can be found in places like New York, L.A., Portland, Dallas, Phoenix, San Jose, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Houston. It's a story from USA Today tech writer Jefferson Graham. Jeff, what's up here?
There is a movement in many of the top cities to switch to apps from the old way of the parking operator going up and down the street in a little cart and putting a chalk on people's tires. Now with apps, you pay with the app. You get a little reminder when your time is coming up. You get the ability to feed the meter. And should you not feed the meter and get a ticket, you can pay the ticket in the app. That's happening in several cities, more than I even dreamed of. It's happening, I think, in about 8 of the top 10 cities now have apps that let you pay. And that's where everything's going.
So great news, I guess, that you can avoid tickets if you get an alert, for example, that is only a couple of minutes left on your meter. But what about, say, revenue for the city itself with, you know, not making money off parking tickets now?
They claim that it's a misnomer that it was a big profit area. They said that, you know, having all this manpower overseeing the meters and dealing with the meters caused a lot, you know, that's where most of the money went to. But people are spending more money at the meter because they can stay there for a little longer. They can buy more time. Because I'm sure, Gordon, you have no coins in your pocket. I know I have none. And it's been years since I've had coins in my pocket to pay for a meter. When they switched to the credit cards, it was just like, that's the greatest thing ever.
Right.
I really don't care how much they charge me. Just the fact that I can pay for it right here and not have to worry about it.
Yeah. You mentioned, too, some license plate technology being used. How is that working and where?
Okay, so there's a shopping mall in Los Angeles. This is what got me into it. When you drive in after you register and sign up for the app, the camera reads your license plate, and thus you're in. You're done. You do not have to pay for parking. It's just automatically charged to your app based on a camera reading your license plate. And from the parking experts that I spoke to, that is the future of the industry. They foresee a time when there won't even be parking meters on the streets. Mm. The streets will be wider, and there'll just be camera sensors on poles that will read our license plates. And theoretically, we'll subscribe to our parking services.
Wow.
And we'll get X amount of hours a month.
Mm. We're speaking with Jeff Graham, tech columnist at USA Today, also host of a podcast called Talking Tech. He's written an interesting piece entitled Coin-Operated Parking Becomes Ancient History as Apps and Sensors Take Over Cities. What about mistakes? These things, these sensors or cameras, they make mistakes?
Yeah, there's in Portland, there's been some people complaining on Twitter that they thought they were in, but they weren't in, and they were being charged. Do you put your total faith in technology? Of course not. But then again, how many times have you gone to a meter and put in a quarter and it went nowhere?
Yeah.
And then you said, well, you know, there have been so many meters that were jammed or broken. So hopefully technology will do a better job than the old technology of coin-operated meters. Let me tell you about one meter that's really cool in Portland, Oregon. It's called the Parking Kitty. That's the name of the app. And once you download it, you get when you feed it, it purrs.
Thanks, Jeff. USA Today tech writer Jefferson Graham. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for 3 straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for joining us. Want to avoid the flu this winter, but you don't plan to get the flu shot? Here's some advice. Avoid millennials. It's a story from Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. Katie, what do you mean?
Yeah, well, millennials, people under 35, are the most likely to admit that they leave the house the last time they had flu or flu-like symptoms. So they are the people going out to a variety of places, not just a pharmacy when they're feeling sick. They're also the least likely to get a flu shot.
Mm.
So they're going outside when they're not feeling well, and they're the least likely to get a flu shot. So that combined made me think, you know, the under 35 set might be the people that are most likely they're going to get you the flu this year, unfortunately.
Hashtag invincibles, right? Isn't that the approach that most of them have?
Yeah. Listen, though, I'm not going to say parents, too, are high on this list.
Oh, really?
Parents of kids under 18, they leave the house a lot, too, probably because they got to. You know, their kids are like, I don't care if you have the flu. I need to be entertained. So they're also leaving the house a lot. This is a new survey from CityMD, which asked about 1,800 people who had recently had the flu, how they behaved.
Mm. The behavior is interesting, too, right? Because, if you work, one, you feel the pressure to show up to your job, even if you're sick, because you don't want to lose it. And two, that could mean that even though you're trying to suck it up, you're sending your sick kid to school because you have to work.
I mean, that's exactly right. That's exactly what's happening. And this work thing, I mean, a lot of people, there's all these other surveys that show that most people feel like the reason they got sick in the first place is because of their coworker. That's a whole nother thing. But people feel like, I'm going to get fired if I call out sick, even though I really am sick. I mean, there's a ton of pressure to go out. Another thing I thought interesting from this survey was where people go when they have the flu.
Yes.
The number one is, of course, the drugstore and the pharmacy. That's followed by the grocery store. But 39% say they go to work. And 20% say they go to a friend or a family member's home. But maybe don't go to your friend's house when you have the flu.
Some friend.
Some of them go to a restaurant or a deli. That was about 15%. I mean, the ATM, public transportation, 8% went to the gym. I mean, they're everywhere. People are going out sick everywhere, and that's why the flu just spreads like crazy.
Wow. Yeah, ATM, yeah. Right? You got your fingers all over those buttons. Gym, you're grabbing the dumbbells. Oh, yeah, that's That's a great way to spread, for sure. We're speaking with
one
Katie Hill.
One expert I talked to said, yeah, those germs can last up to 24 hours on the surface. It depends on the surface. But, yeah, the ATM, you often are touching the ATM right after somebody who's got whatever is touching the ATM. There you go. There's your flu for the year.
I'm speaking with Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com, about her piece entitled Avoiding Millennials is the Secret to Not Getting the Flu This Year. Is there any way to convince these folks that perhaps they need to think more about others and not just themselves when it comes to flu season?
Well, listen, I mean, I think the workplace can do a lot for that, because a lot of these people are going to work and they're getting other people sick. I mean, I think your employer should be a lot more flexible. Hey, if you're sick, just stay home. You can work from home. You know, we can monitor you, but do not come in. You're just going to infect everyone. I mean, I think putting policies like that in the workplace would be a big step.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. She is based in New York. It is 7 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. You know, farmers who let milkweed run rampant had long been considered poor farmers, with its warts, a messy sap that can sicken livestock, and a tendency to grow in tall, shabby clumps that crowd out other plants. Milkweed is not a favorite among growers. But thanks to Canadian clothing companies, the Wall Street Journal says some farmers in Vermont are setting aside acreage to cultivate a homely weed that they have long considered a menace to kill at all cost. Some makers of winter clothing are touting the white, wispy floss in milkweed pods as a plant-based insulating material. Some forecasters say milkweed could yield $800 an acre this year, which Vermont farmers say is better than they get for most commodities. Heather Darby, a University of Vermont agronomist, uses a pitch about the five stages of dealing with milkweed. Her approach is based on dealing with grief. She says the biggest barrier the farmers have is trying to overcome how they feel about the plant itself. She adds, as a crop, it does look like hell. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.